Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What threatens the fragile wetlands of southern Louisiana, and how will the impact on the region's human residents compare with the effects on the ecosystem? Journalist and photographer Kale Alford was raised in upstate New York, but aware from a young age that her grandmother came from a small village near the Gulf Coast, whose residents traced their heritage to both French and Native American ancestors. So when she was sent to New Orleans to cover the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005, she made time to detour to the communities of Isle de Jean Charles and Pointe aux Chênes. She discovered places steeped in both human history and human suffering, whose residents were fiercely determined to remain on the ravaged landscape so dear to them. She documented what she found in an exhibition at Atlanta's High Museum this past summer and in her new book, Bottom of the Boot. She is spending this year as an artist in residence at SMU. Kale, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me here.
So you had returned from working in Iraq. Before that, you were in the Balkans. And the adjustment to life in the regular United States had been challenging for you.
Yeah, and sometimes it still is, actually. I spent my sort of formative young adult years living in Eastern Europe and working as a photojournalist and sort of piecing together a normal, what I could make of a normal life in a place that was always fairly unstable. And so that's what had become part of my identity and just my life experience, you know, was centered around these really dramatic, sort of traumatic experiences and documenting them and always trying to be at the right place at the right time. And events were very visual and very vivid and full of action. It's not actually difficult to make photographs in places like that. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back to the States after about 10 years of this work and after 2 years covering the invasion of Iraq, I was really at a loss of what to do with myself. I went back to New York City, and my family's from New York. I contacted some of the photo editors I knew at the New York Times and took Metro desk assignments in New York City and took a little trips here and there. But I knew if I wanted to live in the U.S., I would have to make a transition and figure out how to do it.
It's interesting. It's almost the opposite problem that other people might have who suddenly get to a war zone and they don't know what to do with themselves because it's overwhelming and they almost don't know how to order things. Because you started that way, that was what you knew.
Yeah, that's what I knew. And I was comfortable. I didn't realize it, mm-hmm. but I had really grown comfortable living that way. And so when I was assigned to cover Hurricane Katrina, I got there about just after Katrina hit, after the city had been evacuated, and maybe 3 or 4 days before Rita came, which I think was 3 weeks after Katrina. And so I arrived at the airport, which had opened again, but none of the luggage conveyor belts were working. The roof was leaking. People were sleeping on the floor. There were people sort of had gotten stranded there because of continued weather delays. And it was the strangest feeling. I just sighed this breath of relief because I felt like I was home somehow, mm-hmm. like I knew what to do.
Yeah. I mean, did you feel guilty about that sensation?
No, not really. I mean, I knew it wasn't normal, and that disturbed me a little bit once I recognized just how powerful that was. Even, you know, then at that point, I'd been in the States for 5 or 6 months or so on and off. But so that was a little bit disturbing, but I didn't feel guilty because I felt in those situations, I feel useful. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was really struggling with, was not feeling useful anymore.
So you essentially on your own time decided to pursue looking into what amounted to not simply a study of the ecology, but of your own family history.
Yeah, it was part of the lore of Louisiana for me. And once I got there and I had the assignment, and one of the reasons I was excited about the assignment was because I could seek out these family members I'd heard about growing up but had never met. There was these sort of almost mythical figures in my family's history, these people who were shrimpers and who lived close to the land. And I had some great uncles there. They're my grandmother's brothers who still live there. And so one day after running around covering a few stories in New Orleans, I talked the writer out of the shared rental car that we had. It was like an SUV, mm-hmm. one of the sort of cars you wanted to use in a place where there's still standing water and lots of rubbish on the roads. And so I snuck that car away, basically, and told him that there was something I really wanted to check out. And I thought it was important to the story, which was not entirely untrue, and went to some shelters because right after Rita, at that point, there are a lot of people who had been displaced by the storm on the coast. Rita didn't hit New Orleans so badly. It made landfall further southeast from, or southwest, excuse me, of New Orleans. And so I went to those places, saw the feeding shelters, and then I started hearing these whispers of Indian communities, houses on stilts that were very remote that had been flooded. And I thought, wow, I wonder if those are my people. So I found my uncle and met him and asked him questions. I didn't really have time to find these communities. I knew they're out there, so I had to go back to New Orleans then, but I vowed to return.
And you write about the fact that far from being like delighted to see you and thanks for telling our story, these were people who had had journalists come in before and basically looked at anybody of your ilk with some suspicion.
Yes, it's very difficult, I think, to be a journalist in the United States in today's climate in many situations because we're so media saturated and there's a lot of suspicion of the media here. People are media savvy. There's, you know, there have been stories the media gets wrong sometimes, and our media is so divided and sort of polarized politically right now. And so people are, I think, in general, a little bit more suspect of the media here unless they have something they want to promote, you know. But in these communities in particular, they'd seen a lot of researchers, anthropologists over the years. They'd seen and a lot of journalists. The local media, the local stations are a little bit more accepted and welcomed because people know those public figures and they know and listen to the radio and the television stations there. So there's a couple of media stations that are welcome. But outsiders who come in, like from CNN or PBS or all the plethora of New York Times people that come there, they're often pretty suspicious. And lately, there's been a lot of films made about this area, at least three recently. And sometimes those relationships kind of go sour because they're seen as commercial ventures and the people in the community never get any compensation from them.
So was there part of you that questioned, well, should I keep going back?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, And I thought I would feel useful there, but I felt redundant and kind of slightly despised sometimes.
It's tough to go in there and then connect enough to make a really good photograph, I would think.
Yeah, it was. I mean, people didn't want to let me into their homes right away. You know, because when I would go, I'd have 1 or 2 weeks at a time. So I'd really, at the most, so I'd really have to be a little bit proactive and aggressive to get the photographs I wanted. I couldn't just sort of wait for a week and then start photographing, although sometimes that's what happened. So I started by just sort of photographing landscapes and people's front yards and allowing the friendly people to come forward or every once in a while knocking on a door and taking a chance. And after a few trips, I did find some friendly characters. And then I would always go there first when I would return so that I felt like I was welcome. It was just emotionally difficult. And I was already having a hard time living in the States and feeling useful here. So I wasn't feeling in the strongest state of mind.
So nothing may describe all of this as well as the photographs themselves, many of which are available online and people can find them. But can you talk about your memory visually of the first time you saw these places, and feel free to correct my pronunciation because I'm sure I butchered the names of both of the communities that you visited.
Yeah, it's Île de Jean-Charles and Pointe-à-Chenne are the two places. And I think I still butcher some of the pronunciations in the area, but I think I have those two right because they're French. It's really, there are a lot of French speakers there, and the fluent French speakers say things always differently than I do. They love to laugh at me, and I let them. But they are, they're really... It didn't look to me like the United States at first. It looked like the cross between something you'd see in the Caribbean.
Yeah, maybe. I thought about Haiti when I saw the picture.
Yeah, Haiti or maybe parts of Cuba or rural communities in South America. The houses, a lot of them are on stilts. Even trailer houses are raised on stilts about 13 feet in the air, a lot of them. That is the further south you go on these small roads along the bayous, the higher the houses have to be. And if they're not raised, they can't get insurance anymore at this point because there have been at least 3 or 4 hurricanes since I started working there. And with each hurricane, the insurance rates go up. So the place is just really very sort of muddy quite often, full of bugs. And because it's not a healthy ecosystem, the trees are dying. There's a lot of debris, trash, and rubbish that gets washed in by the storms that gets left on the side of the roads and in the bayous. There'll be like appliances and these like muddy bayous on the side of the road, and which are little more than drainage ditches sometimes. People pile stuff in their yards because they're constantly dragging all the furniture out of the house when there's a flood and leaving it there, and then it gets picked up, but stuff inevitably lays around. And then they, underneath their houses is where they often live in the summertime when it's really hot. Mm-hmm. So they'll build like a platform under the house or in the yard and come outside in the evenings if the air conditioning's not working, or once the bugs go away and it's a little cooler, they come out for the breeze.
It doesn't sound like something that people would desire to stay with. And I think that is maybe the fascinating thing about this whole project. What did you come to understand about why they want to stay?
Well, there is a lot of poverty in this place. And at first, my overwhelming impression was that it was very poor by the way it looked on the outside. People often don't finish the outside of their houses or finish the inside of their houses. And that always sort of puzzled me initially. And so I felt a kind of like, oh, wow, this place really needs some economic development or something. You know, maybe there's something to be done. Maybe the education isn't good. And the longer I stayed, the more I realized that people live there because they really feel connected to that specific land. I mean, they feel connected the way that, I mean, I think a lot of people in small towns feel connected to places, but also it's deeper than that because they're Native Americans and they see themselves as Indians, and that's what they call themselves, even though they've intermarried with French and other settlers over the years. There's a really fierce kind of protection of a way of life and attention and attachment to this place. So that's, I think, a big part of why people don't leave. And I wonder too, like, there must be other opportunities elsewhere. Couldn't they go to college and go somewhere else? But these people are, many of them are just masterful fishermen, really know the coast and that particular landscape like no one else. And they can make a really good living as fishermen if they are good business people and are lucky. And, you know, some other factors come into play. But I've met some people there. Now I can see that they're incredibly wealthy, but they don't put it into the interiors of their homes the way I see people in, say, Dallas doing. They put into their boats, mm-hmm. and into them just living that lifestyle and saving money and paying for family and other things. And the interior of their houses and the exterior, I mean, why would you constantly fix them up and make them beautiful if they're just going to get wrecked in a hurricane in 2 years? So they just live, their houses look like very simple structures.
Yeah, you read about one guy who had literally gutted and rebuilt his house 9 times.
Yeah, and he's just been flooded again during Isaac. He's one of the few people I know who didn't raise his house, either because he couldn't get funding for it. It's incredibly expensive. It can cost $80,000 to raise your house on stilts, and you might live in a 4-room sort of cypress board house or a trailer. So the cost of raising your house far outweighs anything else in your income.
And so talk a little bit about the importance of the wetlands, because I think people think wetlands, oh, that's nice for wildlife and all that, but they perform a really vital function in terms of protecting dry land if they're functioning properly.
Yes, what I love about this place is that I get a firsthand sort of front seat window on what it means that we are connected to the environment. I mean, this place, people are very literally dependent on the environment for food. They fish for food. They fish to sustain their own diets and family, you know, stocks in their freezers. They really do live off the land, and then their income comes off of the land. And so they, more than anyone I've ever met, can tell me the history of the environment there and how it's affected their own income and the way they live. And a lot of it is due to the impact of the oil industry, a lot of the destruction there.
Journalist and photographer Kale Alford is my guest. She's a visiting artist this year at SMU and author of the new book of photography and photographer called Bottom of the Boot. We will talk more to Kale in a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about two communities in southern Louisiana with photographer and journalist Kale Alford, who documents them in her new book, Bottom of the Boot. She's also a visiting professor, artist in residence, I should say, at SMU right now. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. Kale, we should say for people who haven't made the connection, bottom of the boot means to the extent that the state of Louisiana looks like a boot, this is the very bottom of the state.
Exactly. Yeah, it looks like a boot. And the title came, I'd never heard that phrase before. And actually, I haven't heard it very much since. But I came across the phrase tattooed on this boy's arm. In one of the photographs, he was sort of standing on a porch. It was right after a storm. Everyone was sitting around drinking beer and talking about how they're going to clean up. And I saw this really like rough looking prison tattoo, homemade tattoo, and it said bottom of the boot scrawled underneath it. And I asked him where it came from, and he said, I don't know, I just liked that phrase. And there's a little mark on the tattoo that looked just like where we were.
It's a really evocative phrase, though, thinking about sort of what these people have been through and what's happening to where they live.
Yeah, I mean, if the sort of federal government and the United States, which started as a colony and flushed out most of the Native Americans who were here before, were a boot, these people would be under the heel of that boot. So I think it works as a metaphor. And although these people feel very American, you know, they fly flags in front of their houses that are American flags with Indians or Plains Indians superimposed on the flags. So they feel just as American as anybody else. They go to big blockbuster movies. They go to, you know, conventions, Star Trek conventions, and they like to travel and they like Disney World. But at the same time, they have this other identity that's really important to them.
Talk about how they express and sort of come to terms with their Native American identity, because they've had a really hard time getting federal recognition of that status.
Yeah, they fought for federal recognition for a long time, I think starting in the 70s. They've been recognized by the state of Louisiana as Native American tribes, but federal recognition comes with a whole other host of benefits. Sort of direct access to the federal government. So they can petition directly, if they were recognized, for federal aid, for, you know, issues of cultural sustenance, and they don't have that. And I think that's been a big challenge for them and an important reason why they haven't really been able to stand up for themselves in some ways.
I mean, is there one particular tribe that they feel related to?
Well, that's always the stickiest question. People always ask, what tribe were they? What tribe are these people? And if you ask five different people, you might get five different answers. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that the people who live there, we think, migrated from various other places in the state, and not only in the state, but also from Mississippi and eastern Texas. And perhaps what happened is that people, you know, during the time, this is the now in the mid-1800s, people were moving around as various colonial powers were, you know, struggling and carving up that territory at the time. And so I think people were looking for a peaceful, remote place where they could go and not be bothered. So we think that some of these people migrated there, and they may have come from several different tribes, but they banded together and worked together. So now there is still a petition out there to apply for recognition for some of these groups who call themselves bands of Biloxi, Choctaw, Chittimata Indians who came together and have had a common ancestry and identity for over 200 years.
So for you as an outsider, albeit one with some family ties, I mean, did it feel very authentic in the way that we have been told to look at Native American culture as authentic? Or, in other words, you mentioned Plains Indians on flags and things like that. I mean, did it feel like a recreation of what we understand Native American culture to be?
Yeah, at first, you know, I thought I went into this, I didn't want to have some preconceived notion of who Indians are in this context, because I have done enough research to know that, you know, it's not the same for everybody. Every
Right.
group has their own identity and their own history, and it's ridiculous to lump a whole nation full of tribes together into one thing.
You're not going to make friends that way, certainly.
No, I would not have made friends that way. And so And I was interested that they always called themselves Indians, and they wouldn't really talk about which tribe they belonged to. And I had actually a hard time finding any evidence that they looked that they were Indian. I just didn't see it. So for the longest time, I was confused by that. You'd see it in some people's features, you know, look more classically Indian as we imagine them than others. But some people would have blonde hair and blue eyes and be Indian. Mm-hmm. So I'd see things in their homes that the only physical evidence I could really find was in people's homes. They would hang dream catchers and sort of Kewpie dolls, Native American Kewpie dolls, and have posters of Sitting Bull and slogans that some of the Plains Indians maybe said during the Indian Wars. And I realized, I had this epiphany that being in one thing or another culturally isn't so much about what we see on the outside. It's how you feel about yourself and your own identity, which of course puts them at odds with the federal government, who's looking for these very physical external trappings.
So what's happened to the wetlands there, and why has oil and gas exploration been particularly detrimental?
Well, there are people, elderly people in the communities, who still remember the first time that oil explorers came from some of the, I think that was the Louisiana Land Trust, who came exploring to see if there might be oil, and the state felt that they owned this land, so they began parceling it up to oil companies. And there are people who remember the very first exploration canal that was dredged through this coastal wetland area. It's sort of a brackish wetland area. Historically, some of it was actually freshwater further inland, and as you went further towards the Gulf, it became more saline. And so these oil companies came, and in order to lay oil pipeline, they'd have to dredge these very deep canals and lay pipeline to tap the wells that they'd find. So they'd drill a well and dredge a canal. And people say that as soon as those canals were dredged, and the canal sometimes would lead all the way out towards the Gulf, they'd be longer waterways, and there were also access canals leading to these canals at various points. So it was really a network of these canals. People remember that that immediately began to change how far the tide would come in, how salty the water was, and very quickly, within a matter of 20 or 30 years, they saw vegetation start to die that was used to having fresh water but was now being accessed by the salt water that came in from the Gulf.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org to speak with our guest, Kale Alford, who is author of the new book, Bottom of the Boot. We have Jennifer on the line in Garland. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Great. Thank you.
I love that part of Louisiana. I've always been fascinated with it. And I watch that show Swamp People on cable. And I was wondering if the guest knows if the people that she knows have an opinion on those kind of shows that have come in and filmed in that area, if they have an opinion on, you know, people who are on TV now showing their way of life to the masses.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
That's a great question. I know that show, and my father told me about it for a long time before I finally watched it. And I sort of, you know, I saw it and I thought, wow, they make these people look so comical, like these, you know, crazy, toothless madmen who live in the swamp and wrestle alligators and catch catfish with their hands. And it's not really my experience of what these places are like, although you definitely find characters like that, and they're not that terribly uncommon. But, you know, the way that that show sort of depicts them is hyperbolic. So I thought, oh, they're not going to like this show. And then one day, I'm friends with Facebook on some of these folks, with some of these people. They started posting pictures of the stars of Swamp People with them, like, you know, visiting the community. And I actually then realized I know RJ. He's the sort of guy with the long braid down his back. He's a Native American guy. I've met him and spent a bunch of time with him. He's on Swamp People. He's a really great guy, very knowledgeable, and I think he's one of the hosts of the show. And then the last time I visited, I asked about Swamp People, and everyone likes it. I mean, they recognize it's not particularly accurate. They know it's TV, and they can recognize that difference, that it's, you know, reality TV. They think it's kind of funny, but they actually like the show, and I think they generally like the attention. That's the general perspective I've gotten. I'm sure there's other, you know, points of view. But
where do you stay when you go down there?
I stay with this really lovely woman called Cheryl Edens, who I met one day at the corner store. There's two stores in the community. One has attached to a gas station, a little filling station, and another is like the grocery store where everybody shops. And this woman's family used to own the grocery store, and now she's working at the filling station, or she was then. And I just was kind of keeping my ear to the ground and meeting people and trying to find a local place to live so I didn't have to travel all the way from New Orleans. It's like an hour and a half from New Orleans, and that eats up a lot of time, particularly when I need to shoot in the morning and the evening light. So I met this woman, and she just offered out of nowhere. I told her who I was and what I was doing, and I was kind of looking for a place to stay. And she said, "Oh, just come stay with me." And so I've been staying with her now for like 5 years.
Wow. So you've built that relationship. She must be a great source of insight into sort of what's changed since the last time you've been there.
Yeah, she is. And her brother is was a state representative, and now he's on the levy board. So he's they're kind of a prominent family in the community, although you wouldn't know it really by hanging out with her. She's sort of very, very ordinary and sweet, down-to-earth person. And she has been a good touchstone. If there's ever a storm, I can call her, and she'll tell me what's going on, or she calls me and keeps in touch. And in fact, just in the last couple of years, I probably talk to people there in these communities more often than I talk to my own family, and I hope they don't hear that. But I have really acquired a second family. So there's a handful of four or five people. Kids text me, you know, I get a steady stream. And now I've sort of passed my friends' phone numbers around, and they're getting calls too. So I really have developed that kind of community there.
But they were not particularly impressed by you saying, "My grandmother grew up here."
No, not so much. They'd say, "What was her last name?" is what they'd always ask. And I'd say, "Rodrigue." And they said, "Oh yeah, we have some Rodrigues down here, but they're not Indian." In their mind, because that's really a French last name, although even some of the Indian last names are French. But there's only maybe five or six family names there that are really seen as the Indian names. So my family's French, but they were married into the Billiot family, which is the Indian side of the family. So now I know that we have Billiots. But, you know, for the longest time I went there, I really didn't understand the family tree or the dynamics or the lineages very well. And I went on Ancestry.com and sort of did a genealogical profile. And now I can trace my family back to the first chief of the tribe. So I actually have this very direct lineage to that very Indian ancestry. And I was confirmed when I visited one of the tribal lawyers, and I told her who my family was, and she'd plugged it into the database, and she was sort of shocked. She said, "Oh, you're related to Felicity Billiot." And that's one of the granddaughters of the chief.
Do you see any resemblance at all when you look at old pictures?
The picture of my great-grandmother looks not unlike some of the people there. And she was a very short woman. And the daughter of the chief is called Rosalie Couteau. And in Couteau, in French, Couteau means something like knife or cut. But my great uncle, always told me that he thought that meant short in French. And so that branch of my family, sort of, they're small. And I'm not very tall either. They're sort of small people. And I look at her hands in those photographs, and it's a really eerie photograph from, it must have been the late 1800s. And we really have the same hands.
Yeah, that's cool.
I think everyone can have that experience when they look at old family photos. But, you know, I have like blonde hair and blue eyes, and as do some of the Indians there. But, you know, I don't look Indian.
You mentioned texting some of the kids and having good relationships with them. I mean, it seems like in many small towns that I've been to, and I'm not from a small town, but kids do nothing but dream about the day they get out of there. Is that the case there?
With these two kids that I know the best, and a lot of the young people I know there, not all of them, but a lot of them really feel so connected they want to stay and they don't want to live anywhere else. And people did tend until probably, I don't know, 50 years ago, maybe it started, people intermarried within these communities. And not only these two communities, but a few others along the coast. And you would have, you know, second cousins marrying each other. I've frequently met people whose, you know, both of their last name is Billiot, or they share the same last name and they married because they're not first cousins. So that was really common for people to intermarry. And even now, it's a lot of people still intermarry, but there are more immigrants to the communities now. More people move in, not tons. It's a hard place to live, but a few people feel attached and move in. And then some people do go off and go to school and get good educations. And in a fair number, I would say, increasingly come back and try to help the tribe, come back as lawyers or advocates in some way or social workers.
What are the property values like now, given that I think it was in the book that the U.S. Geological Survey says 50 years the place will be uninhabitable?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't really know what the property values are. There are for sale signs there every once in a while, and I should probably check and see what people are selling for. There's this conception in the community. There's this belief that the property is really coveted by recreational fishermen or for camps, for holiday camps. Mm-hmm. Some people think that the parish wants them out so that they can take over the whole community of Île-de-Jean-Charles and build a fishing resort, like a high-end resort. I can't imagine any developer in their right mind would do that. People imagine the land is valuable.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like they're intelligent people. They're aware of what's going on. Are they in denial at all about the ultimate fate of what's likely to happen to this land they live on?
Well, you know, it's a slow geological process. It's been happening for a long time. I think no one really knows for sure how long it will be inhabitable. Île-Jean-Charles is definitely more vulnerable than Pointe-aux-Chênes. And Pointe-aux-Chênes is a long, skinny community. There's upper and lower Pointe-aux-Chênes, and upper Pointe-aux-Chênes is not so doesn't flood as often, but lower Pointe-aux-Chênes does. So at this point, I think a lot of the people who aren't on stilts, a lot of those people have started to abandon their homes. So if you can't raise your home, it's very hard to live there now. I don't know, after this last flood, I'm expecting to go back and find more and more empty houses. Mm-hmm. After Gustav and Ike, a lot of people relocated. Some of them go further inland. So I think for those people who stay, whose houses are on stilts, they're just going to stay until their house can't stand anymore. And they'll stay until the water's at their front door, I think. So they don't really think about it in the same way I do in the sort of long term. I think they think about it sort of day-to-day, storm-to-storm.
Mm-hmm. You must have just had a pit in your stomach watching all the coverage of Hurricane Isaac sort of getting ready to bear down on this part of the country you've come to love.
Yeah, I mean, every time there's a hurricane forming in the Gulf, I think, oh, no, is this going to be the storm mm-hmm. that, you know, wipes this place out? I mean, if a hurricane hit there the right way, it could wipe the place out. People are very – they're incredibly sensitive to the tides and to the way that storms work. So I'll get a play-by-play from people about where they think the tide is going, and that the tide will go out for 2 days, take all the water out, and then slam it back into the coast. So at least I feel like I have an ear to the ground now.
My guest is photographer and journalist Kale Alford. Her new book is called Bottom of the Boot. She is working as a artist in residence this year at SMU. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist and photographer Kale Alford about her new book, Bottom of the Boot. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You have said, Kale, that you don't believe necessarily that documenting all of this, even as it continues to change, will have a direct impact on whether or not it happens. Is there something, I mean, do you fight against a sense of sort of desperation, like if I don't go this week, maybe something will be gone the next time I go back?
Yeah, particularly in the last, when I was finishing up the book and through 2010, I was worried that, you know, I was going to miss something, or if there was another storm, when I would hear about a storm coming, like Hurricane Ike and Gustav was like that, I thought, oh no, if I don't go now, then I won't get to see this place in this particular circumstance. Mm-hmm. I won't see who's affected by it. And this last time, because I just finished this book, I'm starting on a second book that's more personal accounts of individual residents. I'll sort of photograph around their personal histories and their oral histories. So now with this last storm, I felt like, well, I've done the big documentation. I sort of painted a picture of the place, but I'm worried now that I'll go back and if I don't do it, who's going to do it? I mean, there aren't very many people making these long-term projects. That's the one thing that sets this work apart. You know, it's been 7 years already, and I really have seen a change in that amount of time. But I can't do it all.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard to not be there now, actually.
There are a number of portraits in this book where I don't know how you set them up, but it looks like you took people into their own environment and then said, okay, just don't give me any expression. I mean, how do you sort of set someone up for a portrait like this, and what are you looking for in terms of their expression?
Well, I wasn't much of a portrait photographer before this. I didn't have the best experience making quiet portraits because I was always doing busy, you know, sort of hectic kind of photography.
Sort of jumping around from place to place.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And where things were happening. And here, nothing happened. I mean, it was like geological time I was trying to document. So different, so quiet. So I would find people, rather than do a lot of arranging with portraits, I was much more comfortable finding people in environments where they were commonly there, or they're commonly doing something or engaged in some place in their house or in their gardens. And try to find them at the right moment and then say, okay, just stop where you are, a little to the left, a little to the right. I tried not to move them around too much as best I could. And then because everybody wants to smile for a photograph.
I was going to ask you, everybody's been trained, right?
Everybody's been trained. And it's almost this annoying convention, actually, in the opposite now, because art photography and portrait, like sort of classical fine art portraiture, people don't smile because you're looking for a more earnest kind of expression. And then the reverse, I think, becomes a little bit true, that no one's ever smiling. So it's kind of always a challenge to know how much, you know, to manipulate their expression or encourage a certain expression. But I would just ask people not to smile, especially children, because they'd really want to. And then I would try to take enough frames and stand there long enough that sort of pained, I'm not smiling look would leave their face.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can't get people to forget entirely what they're doing.
Right. I mean, they feel like they're being photographed, although you can sort of stand there long enough that they get a little impatient and they look away and they do something else for a minute. And I try to find the moments where they're engaged with the camera. They're looking. And in this book, they're almost always looking at the camera, which is something I never used to do. It's sort of a big no-no in documentary photography and photojournalism. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to get people sort of pretending you're not there. But in this case, I liked their direct expressions and their direct contact. I felt it was a little bit – they owned the experience a little more if they were looking back at me. And so I told them they could look at the camera if they wanted to, and they often just naturally would. And I'd ask them not to smile. And then I'd look for a moment where I felt like they were present in their body. So they weren't, their mind wasn't totally drifting away. They were sort of there with me. And I tried to get photographs where they at least seem consciously in the presence of another person.
You know, it's an honest approach in a way, because it's impossible not to have your behavior impacted by the presence of someone who's documenting whatever you're doing. Even if it's, you know, you're making your kid's birthday cake and someone's taking pictures, you know someone else is there.
Yeah, you're hyper aware of how you're standing, how you're holding the knife, everything that you're doing. There's really no way around that. The best I can do is sort of talk to them and make it seem like a normal interaction in some way. So I'll talk to them a little bit and tell them what I'm doing and tell them why I'm fussing with my camera and give them a break and say, okay, I'm not going to do anything for a minute. I'm just going to fix this control and give them breaks. But yeah, they're always aware.
And then there's the question of how you edit down. You know, you take essentially for some of these, if we see these people in one photograph, for anyone who comes to this work, you've distilled an entire human life into one frame. How do you pick the right one?
Yeah, it's such an artificial process. You know, it's such an artificial depiction, really, of that place. It's my point of view. It's my particular camera and format and the time I spent there and the people I happen to know. But I think when editing, then it's not really about being perfectly accurate and including everything. It's a matter of finding like the key tropes or the major motifs that I would recognize there, and then including those threads and reinforcing them sort of the way you, I think a lot about writing, actually. I started as a writer before I was a photographer. So when I'm building a body of work like this, a series of photographs, I think about returning to like a common metaphor or a common kind of phrasing and have that repeat at meaningful intervals throughout the work. Like you'll see there are horizon lines in a lot of the photographs. Even if they're indoors, they're artificial horizon lines. And I try to sort of remind you of what the visual landscape looks like. It's wide open space. There are no mountains. There's no hills. It's you and the horizon and sky and sea. So I try to repeat that. And I try to repeat a few times the kinds of Indian symbols that people include in their houses and their interiors. And so certain kinds of lighting, that kind of blue watery light that you see a lot, that was partly choice of film and just the times of days I would photograph. So I try to stitch it together so that it feels like a whole.
I didn't have the chance to see the museum exhibition, but in the book, you don't have the titles next to the photographs. You have to go sort of flip to the back and find these things out. What kind of a choice is that in terms of knowing that someone might look at a picture, never bother to look at the back, and get the wrong idea of what something is?
Yeah, maybe. I think I like that in this work in particular. I don't always like that. With the previous book about Iraq I published, there are captions next to the photographs because there I feel like I was really trying to impart specific information about events and a fixed place and time and something that was very significant people needed to know about in concrete terms. Mm-hmm. But with this work, I feel more like it's like a visual poem. And I want people to take away what they can from it with bringing their own experience and knowledge to the work without being sort of hit over the head with the literal. And even the titles aren't very literal in this work. I try to include enough information and background in the front matter so that people know what it's all about and what's going on. And then they can sort of see the visual music in the place, the way that I experience it just wandering around there.
So between your two trips to Iraq, there was like 7 years. Is that right? Six or 7 years?
7 years.
How prepared were you when you went back last year for the way the country had changed?
I had done a lot of reading and I had stayed in touch with a couple of people, though not very well. It was difficult to stay in touch with people in Iraq. So I had a general sense of what it was like, but I was definitely surprised by some things. I was surprised at there were a lot of barriers that went up around the city to divide different ethnic enclaves and to protect people, like security barriers around markets and things. And though many of them had been removed, there were still enough of them that it really felt different. They're big, tall concrete blast walls. And then people had painted artwork all over them. And they felt like they'd been there for so long that they'd become kind of permanent fixtures and architecture of the city. I was surprised by that. I was surprised about how Shia the place felt to me. Like neighborhoods that had been mixed communities before now had Shia flags and green flags everywhere. I mean, felt like people were staking a claim to territory in a lot of places, in a lot of neighborhoods. And then just the continued sort of insecurity, which I expected, but I was surprised at how like all the people I worked with, all the things I wanted to do, my translator and driver would say, no, you can't go there. That's not safe. This isn't safe. So all the things that used to be possible felt less possible. And I think that was a lot of their insecurity and trauma over what had happened in the past. I don't actually know if it was safe or unsafe. I was only going by their experience was informing it. So that made it really very, very hard to get around and work because they wouldn't take me places. I'd have to fight for every little thing I did.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the difference when you use the word insecurity, the difference between insecurity and fear and why you would use one term and not the other.
Well, yeah, people are afraid, but the insecurity is real. So fear is like your imagination, your projection of what the place is like. And it's informed by your own personal experience. But insecurity is just like every day there'd be a bombing. So there were definitely some real things to be worried about. And I think of the security situation as being something you can kind of chart and watch and make notes day to day about what's happening and where you think you can go. And fear is just getting across that psychological barrier of like, I have to get in my car and drive into a place that may not be safe and I don't know what'll happen.
Did you worry at all that you would lapse back into that sense that it didn't matter unless it was terrifying on a day-to-day basis?
I didn't this time because I went there with a very specific agenda. I wanted to find people I'd photographed in the past and see what had happened to them. because that's how, I mean, I had been away so long, I really didn't know what had changed. And I wanted to see in very specific terms and in terms of some individual lives, what Iraq was like now and what they were thinking based on our shared experience in the past. I feel like that was the best kind of reporting I could really do. And that was hugely valuable. And the photographs were, I have to say, were not that great in those situations. The photographs I like from Iraq this time were sort of other projects I did on the side. But in terms of resonance and the kind of insight I got and the kinds of stories I came away with, I think that work was really meaningful. And so I did do a series of publish a series of stories with photographs. A lot of them were portraits and photographing places I'd been before for MSNBC.com when I got back last year.
I would think that if the people in coastal Louisiana have a measure of suspicion of outside media, that in Iraq it would be off the charts, that people would be so tired of having people, even people who mean well and really want to understand them, having people, you know, sort of come in from outside and then leave again.
In Iraq, it's actually, it's different. There is some suspicion of the media, yes, a little bit. Mostly, though, it's fear. Mm-hmm. People are afraid that being portrayed or named in the media will bring some kind of violence on their heads, which has happened so often. So people are just anxious about being photographed or quoted on the record, their names being used, that sort of thing. And then as far as attention from the outside world, I mean, they feel like the outside world can't really do that much for them. I think at this point, I mean, the Americans intervened with all of our might and money, and look what's happened. I mean, the place is really a disaster. It's not any better off in most ways than it was before the invasion. And so they are just kind of weary and tired. But at the same time, they still want stories told. So it was easier in some ways to get stories told in Iraq. People wanted their stories told if they felt safe enough in Iraq. Whereas in Louisiana, they're just like, yeah, whatever. They're not so committed to, I guess they don't feel like they're in this day-to-day kind of pressure and tragedy. Where they're just compelled to share.
Aside from like fiscal policy and that sort of thing, can every story be equally well told in photographs or in really good prose?
Oh, I think some photographs are better. Some stories are better told in visually, and mm-hmm. some are better told in words. I think that one of the early sort of phrases that I heard from a senior photographer, someone I really respected, who was a mentor, I'd come back from an assignment in Kosovo and he'd ask me, was it good for pictures? And I thought, well, that's a weird question, but he was right. I mean, some things are better for photographs than others. And I think some photographs, a lot of photographs, really benefit also from having some text alongside them. I'm not a purist when it comes to photography. I don't feel like, you know, photographs need to stand by themselves without words, although some things may be more visually compelling than others. But having them together, I think, is always a better package when you're trying to tell a story.
Has anything caught your attention in Texas, or do you want to sort of keep this a place that you come home to and don't have to think about work in quite the same way?
There are a lot of stories I'm interested in Texas, interested in here in Texas. I'm superstitious, so I don't really want to say them out loud yet. But I think this is a great place for stories. I mean, a lot of what's happening in America, I think, across the United States, politically, economically, in terms of policy, I mean, you can find stories about that here. It's sort of like a ground zero for American stories in a way. So I think, and it's visually compelling, a lot of it. Not so much in all the cities, but, you know, geographically outside the cities, it's beautiful.
Kale Alford is a photographer and journalist working this year as a visiting artist at SMU. Her new book is called Bottom of the Boot. There is a link to a website where you can see some of Kale's photographs on the Think page of KERA.org. Thank you so much, Kale, for being with us this hour. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about this show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day. We'll